I'd like to speak just a bit about the structure of Genesis 1. Some people have called it a little monotonous because it takes up these, you can do it several ways, seven masterpieces, and I put them on the board here. And at each case, you have this pattern. It has some variation, and it isn't the only pattern there, but it's the main pattern where the Creator speaks, let there be, and then the creative event takes place. It was so, it happened thus, any variation of that. But then the important thing, I think, for us is that he inspects it, and he says, it's good. It's just what he wants. And that's the way it goes all the way through. Now, there are other words that are used, fashion, make, a comparison of how things used to be and how they are now. Or you can have the word create itself is used. Sometimes there's a separation. Sometimes you'll have generations. That's like beginnings, almost as if it is male and female, the generations of the heaven and the earth in the days that the Lord created them. There are a lot of expressions. The other thing that most people take, and that is they take the days of creation, which really is something else. And so I'll just put it down here. After the creation of light, then you have day one, evening, morning, day one. Then after this firmament is there between the waters up above and the waters below, then you have day two. Then it doesn't fit quite here until after vegetation. You have day three, then day four, then day five, fish and fowl, and then day six is only after the land animals and man have been created. Why? Because you want to get here, and that's the second pattern, and that's the Sabbath, the rest. Now today what I suggest, we had come last time, I think, as far as the luminaries, to kind of work through it rather carefully, and we want to concentrate on what God says as he creates man, man's goal. He creates man in his image. What does that mean? And also, all of creation is to do what the Hebrews very well knew what they should do on the Sabbath, to rest for ordinary work. They're given the job to be fruitful, to multiply, to replenish the earth, to have dominion over it for 6 days of work. The seventh day, they're to rest. And they are to enter into that rest, which God himself established his resting. And that's a kind of an interesting concept. So we have our work cut out. That's one thing I'd like to mention before we go on to text study. Another thing that some of you asked me, and it was only a few of you at the end, I'm not asking everybody to stay, but somebody was asking about where we got this account. And who is writing this? And let me say just a few things about that in a kind of a mini-lecture form, and then I think that other things will become clear. It wasn't kind of an on-the-spot eyewitness report by the first creatures. If you ask about what we have here, I think that I would be willing to argue the point that we have creation materials that go back to far beyond the first person in the chosen people, Abram, certainly far beyond Moses, to a common store. It isn't only Christians and Jews who would speak of creation. There were many ways of speaking of creation in the ancient world. We speak, of course, in the modern world in scientific terminology, and we almost assume we are very self-centered, is that that's the only way to speak of the world in scientific terminology. But people spoke of the world, and the only information they actually had about earlier ages is the traditions they had heard. And here is one tradition which, coming from the very early world, ancient Near East, simply was living through the Christian church and through Judaism. It was the only one until recent times. Meanwhile, we have really archaeologically discovered the stories that the Babylonians told. They called it the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian Genesis. or other, the Egyptians had stories about this too. Now, such traditions, they spoke of the creation of the world in many, many ways. Maybe the one that we should talk about just a little is the one that was perhaps the most widespread in Israel's world, it might say its rival, and that is the Babylonian one. There, what you really had is, it starts off, when in the beginning there was no heaven above and no earth below, when there were no kings and no gods, there was only sweet water, Apsu, and salt water, Tiamat. And that's the way it is in Babylonia. You have the sweet water coming down in the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and it meets the salt water, sweet water male and the salt water female, and at the delta it forms the silt. And then you have, in the stories they told about this, the male and the female beginning in many generations. That's one way of speaking of it. Remember I said that in the Bible, Genesis 2:4 says, now these are the generations of the heavens and the earth in the day when the Lord God made them. And all the way through they'd have a lot of generations. These are the generations of Noah. These are the generations of Shem. These are generations of Adam. We'll see that perhaps next week. But there are other ways of speaking about creation. Sometimes there's a kind of a battle and victory. In Babylonia, what happened is that these old gods of kind of chaos, they were of the marshes, always male and female, and they always had stories about each one of them, their so-called myths. Finally the old gods fought against the new gods. And the new gods wanted to have order. And finally, there was a great battle that's told in their story about how Tiamat, the old mother goddess of the sea, of the salt water, fought against the god of Babylon, and that was Marduk. But Marduk got all the other powers from the rest of the gods and was able to shoot his arrow down into the heart of this dragon monster, and the mouth was held over by wind. It's a very interesting sort of myth and story. And finally, killed her and took her carcass and slit it in two like a clam and put half of it to be the firmament and half of it to be the earth, and then dried it all out, and then put all the various things that are needed in the world, put even a nice little tunnel so when the sun went over from the east to the west it could get into that tunnel, go back in the morning, and put all the stars, and put in a state. Naturally, the manor house was the temple for God Marduk. That's where he lived. He was the king of the universe. And all the other gods and minor gods and goddesses worked there, and that was their economic system, their religious system, and everything else together. And they would celebrate in the great New Year's festival the establishment of this order. And they told these stories, and not only told them, reenacted the stories. There were a lot of ceremonies going connected with it. That's what you might call creation by a battle and victory, and it was always kind of common. And I suppose when the Israelites, you see, Abram is really kind of a Johnny come lately. He doesn't come until the middle Bronze Age, and he's chronological time, what we figure time, BC, maybe 1750 BC, and he comes from his hometown was Ur, way over there in Mesopotamia. Joshua 24 verse 3 says, the fathers of Abram, Terah, and Nahor, when they dwelt in old times beyond the Euphrates River, they served other gods. And then the Lord called them. And I suppose that that was the beginning of their history of salvation, when the Lord revealed himself to Abram. But they had a lot of these old stories. Now, I'm quite sure what Abram and his descendants did, knowing of the Lord who called him, and it's kind of a new ball game, took these things. They certainly monotheized them. They're exclusive monotheists, and they simply will not say that the firmament, as we've had it already, is something that was put there by Marduk or something like that, or that the constellations are separate deities. Remember, we had that last time that the stars are his creatures. He set them up in the firmament. And also over against the neighbors in the Holy Land, the Canaanites, who had their own stories. The Israelites had to always speak of these things from an exclusive monotheistic viewpoint. Thou shalt have no other gods before me, the Lord said. And so this is the way in which they learned of these things. I'm quite sure under God's guidance. And then finally, I suppose if the question was asked me last at the end of the session, well, when did it get into writing? I suppose that it has all the earmarks of those priests who conducted the worship. I think many times these seven masterpieces here, I don't think that just is that some genius, a priestly genius on some Sabbath afternoon just made up his mind that he was going to write a nice story, fiction. But they had been praising God for all the things that he was done, and that's really what you have here, an itemization of all the things that you see in creation. And it takes one after another. It's kind of a list. That's how they did their early science anyway. And much of the Bible was spoken before it was written, and I suppose these priests, in getting all their sacred literature ready for the Second Temple, are getting all the scripture that was necessary for their celebrations and putting it down in writing. And this is how perhaps it came to us. But I want to emphasize this, that you shouldn't get the idea that the account that we have here in Genesis, though it is in Hebrew, is one that just comes very late and was created by some, well, religious genius. But I think it was the result of a lot of probing by many generations of believers who, taking all of this creation material, simply put it into the form in which we finally have it. And I think that, well, let me stop here for a moment. I think what we should do is, in our session today, finish up, I think we've gone as far as that luminary. That would be kind of the fourth masterpiece. And then spend our time, as much time as we have today, on the section on the creation of mankind. Let me stop there for a moment, because I did speak here quite at length about the background. Does anyone have any questions about that? Clarification? Yes?
It doesn't seem to me that the move to a monotheistic creation story would necessarily move to a creation story which is asexual. And some other myths at any rate that have endogenous creators. And I'm just wondering, is there any background information that would clarify the move to this kind of asexual creation story? Mm-hmm. Or is that, you know, asking you to speculate about such small fragments that they can't really do?
Well, there's no doubt about this, that when the Babylonians spoke of their creation story, that it was sexual. This is generations. There's also no doubt about it that in the Bible, these priests use as their structure, their framework, the generations. In first Genesis 2:4a, this is the generations of the heavens and the earth in the day that the Lord made them. It's rather interesting. But that's been demythed, you see that? It's asexual, as you said. Then the next one, and now these are the generations of man, of Adam, in chapter 5. Adam lived 120 years and begat sons and daughters, and then lived so many more years, begat other sons and daughters, and he finally died and somebody else took his place, you know, that whole business. And then you have these are the generations of Noah, and then the sons of Noah, Shem and Ham and Japheth. And then after a while you have Shem, and finally you get to where you really want to get, and that is to Abram. So the way the Hebrews do that here, I think the reason for them making this asexual is not because God has personality, but his sexuality isn't, he doesn't have genitals, and he doesn't have to beget demigods or something like that. I think they're leading up to a general history of salvation. This is not yet the history of salvation. This is kind of a universal prism, a primer, you might say. But what happened there, you're kind of asking me, is how did the earliest believers in the Lord who revealed himself to Abram and Moses and all these people, how did they conceive of creation? The best you could do on that was to take something like Psalm 29, which speaks of the Lord as the Lord of a storm, not Yahweh as the Lord of a storm. And it's the same sort of thing that the Canaanites would speak of when they spoke of their god, a thunder god, Baal. But what the Israelites did here was simply took over all that stuff, just the way we Christians have taken over the 25th of December from the Roman Saturnalia, and simply made it a Christian celebration. So there isn't much left of a Saturnalia. We kind of eat too much and misuse Christmas, but we don't feel that. It's almost the way in which Israelites weren't supposed to have a king. That was a no-no. The Lord was supposed to be their king. But after they finally asked for the king enough, the Lord finally gave in and said, you can have a king, but not like the first one, Saul, who was a kind of a fizzle, but David. And then it was a promise even to the line of David. You see that? So the Lord made something out of it that it wasn't before. I think that's what's happening to these creation traditions. They had been quite sexual. They had been polytheistic, myth-drenched. The Egyptian stories we talked a little about last time, the pyramid coming up and the god Ptah creating. So there are parallels, I think you'd have to say that. But they're not exact parallels, as you rightly point out. Am I answering somewhat your question there?
Oh, yeah, very much. It just struck me that to make God utterly other,
mm-hmm.
and asexual is conceptual, is a trivial.
Yes, it is. I think God has personality, and some of the women livers have said, well, that there is also in the Old Testament description of God a lot of feminine characteristics of his mercy, which is actually rachamim, which is almost his motherly instincts, you might say. Now, but I think that largely, I suppose it was mostly because the culture was a male culture, it's usually speaking of it's he, do you see that? But I don't know, we'd have to ask him someday when we're in glory, whether he could have done it some other way, do you see that? But this is kind of, I think God enters the stream of history and finds people where they are, and to finally get his message across as he has in the Judeo-Christian tradition, that's what has simply happened to the tradition. Well, listen, let's go on today. I don't want to cut off any other questions, but let's go on to that fifth masterpiece at the top of the page, which it says 22, but it's supposed to be 2. And I'm Fish and Fowl. And could we ask you to perhaps read? Would you mind reading that section, verses 20 through 23? Because it's always nice to get this right from the Bible itself and then begin our discussions.
And God said, let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the firmament of heaven. So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm, according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the sea, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening, and there was morning, a fifth day.
All right, I'll have a rather unstructured question. Did anything strike you? Anything strike you that you'd like to comment on or ask questions about?
Sea monsters.
Sea monsters, all right. Shamu the whale, the killer whale, and all the rest, okay? Why not the algae and the krill and all those things? Well, I'm quite sure it doesn't exclude them, you see that, but I like this first part where it says, let them bring forth swarms of living creatures. The old King James is always a good translation. Let them bring forth abundantly. Have you ever disturbed an anthill? and it all goes here and there. That's what it, what the Hebrew word means. Shirat shiratsu, you can almost hear it. Abundantly let it bring forth all this stuff. You can just see that it, the waters are full of all this stuff. And the birds here, they aren't just silent or anything. They're flying across the firmament of heaven. And I like that that you saw the whales there, the big sea monsters. And the Israelites, of course, they didn't see humpback whales. They would scare the life out of them. If you see pictures from those days, they would picture, like the Assyrians were picturing people bringing down logs from the cedars of Lebanon. They always put all kinds of monsters in the sea. And they looked like winged monsters and so forth. And they had Leviathan and the Behemoth and all the rest of them. Scared them out of their wits. We're not quite so scared of them. But later on God will say, you don't have to be afraid of them. We talked a little about that last time too, of birds of prey. They're not mentioned here as such, but they're his creatures too. And it says here, he saw his good. Here is something new though, verse 22. And that is that God does what? Blesses them. It's not magic, but that God's own creatures, this God-given life, continues, and they propagate their kind. So everything that you've got, from the littlest amoeba to the biggest condor, these are God's creation. Well, let's ask this one question. Where in the Bible do you have all the predators finally being at peace and not eating one, the survival of the fittest, one eating the other, including us carnivores here in this room? Where don't you have predators, or at least predators without teeth?
Isaiah.
Yeah, and Isaiah 11, isn't it? In the Messianic age, the lion will lie down with the lamb, and the little child will play with the asp and the adder, and all these things. But that's going to be in the end time, you see, when the Messiah establishes his kingdom. Now, I think the Bible still says they're all his creatures. It may not always seem good to the rest of the creatures, or if some wild animal, some bear, gets after us, we might not seem, but they're his creatures, and I think there's a joy in that. Well, I won't spend a lot of time on that unless someone asks a question there. Let's take land animals. Yes, Mary? Yeah.
I always thought my idea of what the beginning creation was, that the animals had the same appetite that they do now, and that they lived by, were they all vegetarian before the fall?
Well, what's really interesting, I can't answer your question, but what's really interesting is when we get to man, he says, you got to be vegetarian. So could you mind delaying your question till we get there? Because there the Bible speaks of it. It doesn't speak of it here, you see that? It does speak in the book of Job about it. It says that, look at the hawk. And that certainly is the predator. That's my creature. It mentions the raven and the young raven who cry unto God for their food. And we know what kind of food that is. You see that? Thou openest thine hands and satisfiest the desire of every living thing. One lady told me that she was a missionary, a single lady working in India for years. She said, I cannot pray that in India. And so there are some really bugs in this as we go past it. It says everything is good. Doesn't seem always to be good. And you're raising that question. But let's wait till we get to the question of man and whether man can eat the rest of the animals. In Genesis, 29 and 30 will mention that. But let's just continue where we are for the moment so we touch all bases. How about the sixth creation work? Would you mind reading that next for us, please? That's verses 24 and 25.
And God said, let earth bring forth living creatures according to their kind, cattle and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kind. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth earth according to their kinds, and the cattle according to their kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good.
Yes. Someone told me, commented, said, I was surprised what you said yesterday, and I wasn't, I said it, the Bible said it, that the earth bring forth all these creatures. Here it says the water, and now here it says the earth again, doesn't it? And I suppose that if water is the place where all these fish breed, then the various habitat that you've got in the earth, the desert should be the habitat for what? The camels, isn't it? And the mountains for the mountain lion in each part. And I think that's what it's getting at here. I don't think that it's trying to get our type of science or something like that. But I think all it classifies the creatures here, again, this some people may think it's primitive, is three types. You've got cattle, that's domesticated animals. Then you've got creeping things, all right, reptiles, I suppose. And then you've got the beasts, the wild animals, undomesticated. And instead of doing the way we do it in modern zoology, vertebrates, invertebrates, and so forth, they just classify them. And that shows that they were kind of interested in their own way in what we call science, because science is basically classification of the whole thing. But they simply say, this is God's creation. And then, does it mention here that he blesses them? You'd surprise, I would think that you would have had the plants being blessed. I think Omar would just soon have them blessed too. And I would just assume that the land animals would be blessed too. It doesn't mention it, does it? It does mention in the case of the fish and fowl, and I can raise the question, but I can't answer it. And it mentions in the case of men, doesn't it? Be fruitful and multiply. Well, I think that if you notice the last part, and God saw that it was good, that's the sixth time that that pattern has been used. And one other time it'll come, and then it will be, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Well, now we get to the seventh masterpiece, and that's the climax. Would you just continue reading there, and why don't you read, well, everything from 26 to 30. Do you mind, please?
Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and climb, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, over every living thing that moves upon earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food, and to every beast of the earth, and every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps upon the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so.
And it was so. Okay, now, what strikes you here? A number of things should strike you. Yes?
The first thing that strikes me is where let us make man an hour.
Who is the us and our, all right? The traditional answer, and it's not a bad one, is that the Father is talking to the Son and the Holy Ghost, and the Holy Ghost is talking to the Father and the Son, and the Son is talking to the Father and the Holy Ghost, and the Holy Trinity is referred to, see? And the Hebrew word for God is a plural. Though in English it's a singular, in Elohim in Hebrew is a plural. It seems there's a lot in God. And so he can use the plural. That's one explanation. Does anybody know any other answers? Who is he talking to?
Maybe talking to maybe other angels or something.
His heavenly cabinet, you mean?
Yeah.
All right. To Gabriel and Uriel and Raphael and all the rest of them, saying we've got a big project now in this world, and we'd better have some representative to take care of it down there. Let's make man in our image, well, and then it would be almost as if their creature is going to be something like the creatures that are around God's estate in his throne room, to see that in his Oval Office. All right? Okay, does anyone have no another explanation? Yes. That's maybe the psychological we. But the editorial we, or you have to, we don't live in England, but the Queen always says what? We. What about the Pope? He's supposed to say we, isn't it? Because after all, he's the Pope. Except that nice Pope John, he always said I, and they always had to correct him. I didn't say he always did it, but that happened a number of times. But, so you can take your choices. I said I don't have three crowns here, so I can't tell you which one is right. I don't think that we know everything about God, and maybe all of them are right. Well, I don't think it's as close as. Personally, I like the editorial one. But anyway, let's go a little farther than that. This is different. At every other point he says what? Let there be, or let the earth bring forth, or let the waters bring forth, isn't it? Here it says what?
Let us.
Let us. So there's something distinctive. And then something that's even more distinctive, this should be in our image. Well, now I can see an image of myself if I look in the mirror. And now, what does that mean if God creates a creature, this creature, that's going to be in his image? Well, what would it mean? It would mean that you looked at that creature, and what would you see?
Very like him.
You'd see God. Mm-hmm. Could they have any images in ancient Israel? No, the commandment was, thou shalt not make any image, wasn't it? Yeah, like me, any likeness out of anything in heaven or below, and you couldn't do that. What did they have in the temple, in the Holy of Holies? In a heathen temple, what would you have there? You'd have a statue of Athena or a statue of the gods, the goddess of the temple, of Marduk. What would you have in Israel's, what was there in the Holy of Holies, in the most holy place? Yeah, but that Ark of the Covenant is merely the throne for God, and he sits invisibly above it. That's just his throne, and there's nothing above it. By the way, the Roman general Pompey once went into the Holy of Holies. The priest just about went to wacky to try to keep him out, but he was the conqueror, and he went inside, and he said he was surprised there was nothing there, just that box. He hadn't expected it. But let's try to get this. If you're not supposed to make any image of God, and then, nevertheless, this creature is made in God's image, where can you see God?
You know,
in that creature. Is that it? Well, that's rather surprising. Well, let's ask the question a little more deeply. This is, how do you define anthropologically the creature that we call man, Homo sapiens, mature man, wise man? Harold, can you help me out? A wingless biped without feathers. Okay. But wouldn't some apes get pretty close to be hominid then? I think you'd have to go a little farther there, wouldn't you? I'm not an anthropologist, so I can't beat you at that game. What? All right, he's a toolmaker. He's a homo faber. He's a man that can pick up and make tools and so forth. I think it's a distinctive thing. What else makes this creature, we have to define it? Say some things are human creatures and some things are not. Well, I think they measure brain capacity, don't they? Isn't that one of the main things? How big the brain is? What did Aristotle say? Don't ask the philosopher, not everybody else. Is a description of man. Well, the philosopher's definition is what? He's a rational animal. An animal that does what? Philosophizes. Thinks. And is rational. So I think you can have many definitions of man. Now, let me say it this way. I've been teasing you a little here. I think that that phrase, in his image, you don't have to agree with me on this at all, is an adverbial phrase with the word create. So I don't think that by looking at me you can see God, heavens no. I do believe I'm God's creature, and I do believe that I have a history with God. But if you do it this way, don't take that as an adjective. Most people take that as an adjective. And then they say, well, there's some special property that the human creature has that comes with all models and never can be lost, not even through death. And they usually identify it with soul or something like that. And I don't think that washes. I think that if you take this as an adverbial phrase with the word create, let us create him in our image in such a way that just like an image reflects whoever the person is, the history, that this creature can only be what God intends that creature to be as he has this history and this back and forth with God. In other words, I guess I'm settling, and I think this is what this is. I think this is a theological definition. It's not a physiological definition, you know, a creature that's so big or so small or philosophical. But I think it's that creature that as it has its history with God is what God intended.
Refer to his holiness. I mean, he did create man holy. He was holy.
Yes, but even when man is far driven out of the garden, he's still man. He's lost his home where God would like. He's far from him. But he's still held responsible by God, and God treats him as a human and has his history. God doesn't only have history with Christians. He doesn't only have history with Jews. He has history with all humans, and that seems to be a special history. Now, I know he has history with the birds, too, and with the stars and all these other things. But all I'm interested right now is this phrase, in his image. You see that? And, well, put this on for size, and if you want to buy this pair of shoes, go ahead and buy it and use it until you find a better pair of shoes, then buy that one. But that this is an adverbial phrase that describes the manner in which God has created this creature, a creature that is to have this sort of relationship. And now what that relationship is going to be, well, the Bible will, and the people who are telling these traditions will finally tell you as you can keep on reading and hearing.
But you're assuming from the difference of this one that it's a relationship different from that relationship to firmament or green things or flying.
I think that God has a history with all of his creatures, the slugs and the plants and even inanimate things. A surprising thing in the Gospels is when Jesus talks about resurrection life to the Sadducees. They bring this trick question to him about this poor gal who had been married so many times. They say, in the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? Which one of these guys? And then Jesus says, in the Lucan version especially, you err because you don't understand the scriptures and you think that that world is going to be like this world where you buy and sell and you make all your business propositions and so forth. It isn't going to be that way. It isn't just that there's not going to be no sexuality there. The buying and selling and giving in marriage was a business deal. Then Jesus says, the scripture says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he's the God of the living. He's not the God of those guys who died, but he's the God of those that live. And then he says, all things, in Greek it's pantos, all things are alive unto him, to God. So God does have, with all creatures, a real history. Do you see that? But this human history is going to be history that will be characterized by the sort of stories that we have here in the first 11 chapters of the Bible, And then if you're a Jew, underneath the Sinaitic covenant, or if you're a Christian, underneath the New Testament. And that will be a history there that has other dimensions. Do you see that? But I don't really like this idea. A lot of times people say, well, here God is talking about a soul. Do you see that? And that gets to be kind of Platonic, whereby you say, well, every creature has the image of God, and that's a soul that is standard equipment with every model, and it goes right past God. And I think that, what does it say in 2 Timothy? God only has immortality. And those only have really that life to whom God gives it. You see that? And here God is going to say that man, and that's part of man, we'll have to have this for the rest of this week if you want a full definition of this, man also dies, you see that?
I have a question on that too. I wondered about in 2 and chapter 2, then this is in chapter 2, verse 7, where he breathes into man the breath of life. How do we deal with that then? That's going to be different from the way he's dealt with the animals then.
I think that this is a very good point. In chapter 2, at the beginning here, first of all, you know, he's going to make this creature. And the first thing he does is to give it the breath of life. You see that? And that's the first thing that we have. Then he plants a nice garden and gives them all kinds of fruit, kind of like he has here, does here, a nice home. Then he gives him work to keep it and to dress it. Then he gives him responsibility, he gives him command. And then finally he gives him two types of community. Community with other creatures, all kinds of other animals, and then finally a wife and human community. And I think then you're genuinely human. And finally then the man says, at the end of the whole chapter 2, now at last, this is what I've been waiting for. And then he's genuinely human. But I wouldn't take that verse by itself as if the thing that people are talking about is that the man has a human soul. You see, the Mormons have really, in the book of Pearl of Great Price, they make hay on that. They not only have God with genitals, God the Father has genitals, and there's God the Mother there too, but they have created souls, and these souls have to have bodies, and that's why you guys better get busy and have large families for all these souls. You see that? That sort of thing really is not biblical at all. Do you see what I'm getting at? I'm not saying that that's what you're doing. But if you say that that is the distinctiveness of man, that in some way, as a creature, he possesses and holds and controls that life, which goes beyond death, and if that's what's referred to here, I would have my great doubts about that thing. But you'll have to figure that out for yourself. I really don't have any special insight except what I'm telling you here.
Yeah. Possibly, I don't know if you're referring to the translation of that verse. King James says, and he breathed in the breath of life, and he became a living soul, or he became a living being.
It wasn't that he was a ghost flitting around without a body. It wasn't that. It means body and soul. Yes. That word soul, of course, is really very tricky and a slippery one, and that's why I would avoid it. So, basically, though, that passage is referring to the same sort of thing that you have here. Well, let's go on a little farther here. When you read...
Is there any sense to the interpretation sometimes given that man is in God's image insofar as man, like God, the kind of creator, and ruler, like God? Is that all consistent with the text?
Oh, yes, I think it's very consistent, because he says, have dominion over it. See that? Yeah. And I think that it's in this sense that he's to be fruitful, multiply, and create. And Cain is the creature that the woman says, I have created a man with the help of God, and gives him the name creature, Cain. That's really what that means.
Yeah, I was thinking of man not simply as co-creator, but more as archetype. An archetype being, their activity going along with ruling, having dominion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that these two activities, artificing and ruling, would make man in God's image because he's God's creation.
I would not exclude that. Actually, what we are doing here is we're trying to... all the Bible does here is tell a kind of a story. You see that? What we're trying to do is itemize it so that we include this all in a kind of a philosophical definition. And that's all right. I don't mind that. But as it does it here, all you have here is when it comes to this creature, God says, let's be sure to make this creature in our image. And it comes to poetry then, because as it says, it doesn't just say, and it was so, it says that at the very end, but it says in verse 27, let's just look at that for a moment, it's actually poetry, Hebrew poetry. So God created man in his own image, in the image of God created him. That's all the kind of rhymed thing. And then, notice though it says him, all of a sudden it turns a switch on us, and when you read that, you almost said him and them together, because it says male and female created he them. First you have the singular, the species, and then all of a sudden you have the plural, isn't it? In other words, that's another thing that we'll have to include in any description of what is human, and that is sexuality. In other words, a human doesn't...
Man, the procreator, has to work as a sexual being. He's much more like, you know, the lower creatures. But insofar as man is an artificer, then he's not a sexual being. Rather, he's working out of a sense of freedom. And I suppose the real similarity that I would want to argue for, that it means that man possesses a kind of freedom, as God possessed freedom, that it was God's sheer willful act brought the world into existence, and man, through a kind of freedom, you see, can also bring things into existence.
Yes. I would put that, however, not particularly as an explanation of this verse.
Uh-huh.
I would put that as the one of having dominion.
Uh-huh.
And later on, when you have the genealogy in chapter 4, he'll mention all the cultural achievements of man,
mm-hmm.
including religion. Not only is he's the first farmer, and then king, the first farmer, the first rancher, the first artificer in bronze and iron, Tubal Cain, the first musician, and all these things are mentioned, the cultural achievements, and that's part of being human. But I still would go back to this, that, and that's all I want to say, is that somehow a human being also is sexual. And that part of
our... Clearly, it's about a human being sexual, it's not an image of God.
I wouldn't make the image of God sexual, no.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to do that.
Yeah.
All I'm trying to say is that as a human being who has this history with God, that's the way I take the image of God, that he does that either as male or female. And it doesn't come in any other way to see that. Let me put it a little more drastically. A person that would deny sexuality is not a fully human, you see that? In other words, a person that would... imagine that in some way or other, it does not necessarily have to be married. I happen to be celibate. Sister Ingeborg is celibate, and I think we're sexual beings, you see that, to the very fiber of our beings, even though we're not living in marriage or something like that. But I think that if I would want to deny that sort of thing in some way, I doubt whether I'd be a human. In fact, I say to my friends that the next time I go around, I think I'll raise a family and realize that, you see that. But I think that's a very deep thing here. And I don't think the Israelites would have understood anybody that was not married. In fact, I taught for 1 year in the mission in New Guinea. And I would ask them, the whole first week I was teaching them, you have any questions? And the guys never ask any questions until the last day. The oldest one asked me the question, how come you're not married? Are you like a priest? And I said, no, that right girl didn't ask me. I didn't quite say it that facetiously, but that was the question. They couldn't understand it. They said, what's wrong with your tribe? They didn't give you a wife. No, they really couldn't understand a human being not being married. Because even the idiot in the village in New Guinea is married, and they would not deny that. And I think that's really what you have here when it speaks. So I don't think the image of God would consist in sexuality, but I would think that this history that we have would include sexuality.
I just go back to this in this, talk about in this image, often in, again trying to explore this confirmation class, and then raise the issue or try to expand on that, that man in this, having this history and this relationship with his creator, may it not necessarily so distinctive from the animal world or the rest of the animal world, but that it can include at least the man's dimension, the capacity to not just have emotions, but to know what love is and to forgive. I think, you know, that God also is the forgiver, but that man then can also exercise this forgiveness.
Well, yes, I guess...
Is that too rambling too far?
No. I think that, to me, the description or definition of man has not yet really been worked out yet. It is still part of this ongoing history. I think we've learned an awful lot through Jesus as to what genuine humanity is. And so I would conclude the forgiving that you are. But I don't think that the history that God has with this creature is by any means done. Now, he maybe isn't done with his history that he has with the slugs and all the other creatures, too. But at least we as humans, and this is in human language, and we'll have to try to understand it from that point of view, would more or less learn that this is the future that he has. Now that brings us to this really conundrum, and I guess our time is, how much time do we have? Well, we have about 7 minutes, that's all right. I pushed it off before when Mary raised it. This business about not only being fruitful and multiply in verse 28, filling the earth, subduing it, having dominion, and that word radah in Hebrew is the word for a king. And an Israelite king was not an absolute monarch who could do anything he wanted. He was underneath the covenant, you see. And therefore it doesn't mean that we can simply plunder and kill off all the animals, and that's the way we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be God's representative, and as a king lived and ruled in righteousness, so man is to do that too. That's the idea of dominion. That would include what Harold meant in cultural achievements. And now comes the kind of the surprising thing, and I don't know what to do with this entirely, where he simply says, I've given you the plant, just as I've given it to every beast, to wild beast, to every bird, to everything that creeps, I'm giving you also this for food. Now what does that mean? Isn't man the worst of the predators? Does that mean we better stop eating meat here in Holden Village? Did the Israelites, were they, did they eat meat? Or did anybody know that? We have to start, this is ancient Israel, we have to start with them, not just what we might think we'd like to do or can do. Did they eat meat? The people who read this? They didn't eat as much as Americans, but they ate it. When did they eat meat? Well, not usually every day. They were more vegetarian. They ate a lot of grains and things like that, fruits, vegetables, but a sacrifice. And even if it wasn't a sacrifice at the sanctuary, later on, be at home, you had to pour out the blood to the Lord. The blood was the life. And if you didn't thank God for it, it was unclean. It was not kosher. And then you could eat it. But how come they read this? How come they weren't vegetarians? Why weren't they like Hindus? They read this as much as you and I are reading it. I'm asking you the questions now.
this is more of a poetic, it's not completely detailed.
Does anyone know where in Genesis, first parts of Genesis, man gets the permission. It's kind of a compromise that he can't eat meat. In chapter 9, after the flood, when God is restoring all the things that have been ruined in the flood, when, let me see, I'll give you the exact verse here. In chapter 9, verse 3, when he is talking about the new world, and then the question is, will that new world after the flood be any better than the old world, or will it be the same old problem? And then he says, be fruitful, multiply, the same things that he has here in Genesis. Replenish the earth, have dominion over it, and your domestication of animals can go so far that you can domesticate them and eat them. But you have to be careful with the blood. What must you do first with blood?
Drain the blood from the animal.
Drain the blood from the animal. By every altar, I think you know that even in Jerusalem, you had to cut the throat and drain the blood out, and that was the Lord. Then, well, there were some sacrifices, you know, that they're wholly burnt to God, and nobody got any portion. Some of it was kind of barbecued, and they had a nice festive one. That's where you got some of your meat, you see that, and I think they enjoyed it as much as we did. But that was kind of a permission. And the idea was that in the future, Pastor, you were right when you mentioned that the future, it isn't really God's will that his creatures live one off the other. You see that? Somewhere, we're not by any means in the future that Genesis 1 refers to. And that's why I'd like to suggest that to you, that as you talk about the image of God, you talk about what is human, you don't look in the past, but that you look to that history which God has with his creatures. And if we were Jews here, I think we'd have to look at it very seriously under the Old Covenant. As Christians, we'd look underneath the New Covenant and that future. And that hasn't been worked out, and part of that is our own obligation to work out. In fact, this comes in here in a command, see? But it's a rather surprising sort of thing. A lot of people don't even talk about this, do they? How many of you have ever heard about this, that Genesis 1 teaches vegetarianism? Okay, a few have. Yeah, all right. Most of the time it's not talked about at all. They talk about Genesis 9 and they say, well, it's all right to eat meat. But it doesn't seem to be that this is God's original plan.
Are there religions that are vegetarian and vegetarians still vegetarian?
No, I think that, well, some of them do that on their own basis, like in Hinduism. Certain parts of Hinduism, you see that, be vegetarian. No, I think that the Jews know this very well today, and they're very careful about kosher meat, you see that.
Yeah.
It has to be drained out, even if it's in a slaughterhouse, say nothing. See, they don't have really a temple anymore because the Arabs have a Mosque of Omran over the top of it now. But give them a knock and bacon a few years and maybe have that there too, having some prayer in right now. I don't know. I'm just talking through my head here. Let's finish this up, though. At the end you have this, God says, very good. Verse 31, I'll read it just to save a little time here. God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. It was evening and morning, a sixth day. Now comes into that great Sabbath, the seventh day. By the way, this very good, I think you should take this the way it says right here. God says it's very good. In his eyes, it's very good. It may not be always very good to us. And there are a lot of things that are quite ruined, and I can't straighten them out either, in creation and whatnot. I don't think creation is always so good. Do you all think that creation is so great? It's all so beautiful? I think sometimes it's horrible. And insects eat insect, and one thing after another, and I don't think it's always in that sense that we realize that. That's a statement of faith in the contrary, in the face of contrariness.
Well, I think it's always baffled me, though, in relationships then. Well, then, but then since that, this is, you know, pre-fall, how much did the whole creation suffer? And the fall, you know, talks about the whole creation groaning, waiting for redemption, you know, and talks about the
mm-hmm. well, that,
labor. And,
yeah,
and
now
and
you're,
that.
When you put that in the terms that you're doing that, chronological terms, do we have any time of the world when lions were not lions, when adders were not adders and poisonous. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll have to really. Well, and we'll
yeah, this is what I don't know. I don't know.
No, I don't know that either. But I think, though, that as we take the stories, especially the story in chapter 3, that will become quite apparent what it meant. Here it's quite clear that, at least as far as God's concerned, is quite different than some religions which would say everything was created wrong. You see that?
Yeah.
Here, God's creation and God's creative act is good, and since it's good in His sight, you can trust Him in that sense. And you don't have to fear even all these other things that otherwise might be potentially dangerous. Then finally, the conclusion is this Sabbath business. Let me just say a few words about, so we can go on to some other things tomorrow. This day is hallowed and blessed by God. Now, as I said at the beginning, so they can work and have dominion and are supposed to work the 6 days and the seventh day, and Jews perhaps understand this better than we do, they're not to work. God is to work through, that was the day of rest, the day of worship, through His word, there to praise Him, if you call that work, but that's something else. And that's a different activity. And then the next verse there, this is the generations of the heaven and earth in the day that the Lord God made them, when He made them. That's just kind of surprising, isn't it? Here, Harold, what you were saying, that Genesis doesn't do it, almost does it when he talks about generations. You see that? He talks about heaven and earth. Now, we know in some of the stories you had Mother Earth is a female, and Uranus and the heavens is male, and they were brought together, are cried apart. And Egypt doesn't have that here. I think if there is any background of that in the old traditional use of this, I don't think that it's that at all. So you could practically translate, this is the history of the heaven and the earth when God made it. But history isn't a very good word there. I don't know what to do with it. Perhaps their old word generation is just as good as anything. The Hebrew word is toledot. Well, anyone have any parting shots? I don't know, they have run over our time, I'm afraid, so. Anyone would like to stay here and discuss anything further, fine, but I think I'd better dismiss you on time here.